here's, I think, a very important contribution that science is making to our thinking about morality. It's showing that these old-fashioned distinctions, which might make a sharp differentiation between us and animals, don't stand up anymore. And of course, one of the things about Robert Koch's investigations reinforces that point. Because if there are animal models for human beings, that's suggesting similarity between us and human beings. If they can get TB and we can get TB, well, at least we're similar in that regard. I mean, if they didn't get TB and we did, okay, well, we're different from them with regard to TB. But the very fact that animals can be used as models for human beings suggests that there are more similarities than other people might have recognized. Now, maybe those similarities are sufficient to suggest that some kind of moral consideration can be extended to animals from humans. Again, the big issue that we're addressing here is the domain of moral consideration. Who are moral subjects? Is it just members of Homo sapiens, us? Or is anybody else to be included? If nobody else is to be included, then whatever we do to animals, whatever we do to the environment, doesn't have any moral sanction attached to it. It's purely a matter of our instrumental interests. It's a matter of prudence. It's a matter of stuff coming back to us. It's anthropocentric. All morality is anthropocentric. Anthropos, me, human being, centric, comes back to me. The question we're interested in here is whether we can extend morality beyond us. Can we extend it, for instance, to animals? Do they deserve some kind of moral consideration? If they do, why? That's what we're debating. What I've tried to suggest is one reason why not doesn't stand up anymore. I haven't disproved this at all. I don't think I could. But the kind of work which is being done in biology seems to suggest then that we're a lot closer to animals than we were thought. And the evolutionary argument seems to suggest that we're really very close to animals indeed. Well, what else can be said in an attempt to try to restrict moral consideration to us? What I'm trying to do is to, first of all, give you arguments why moral consideration could be extended to animals, and secondly, to destroy arguments to suggest that it should be restricted to us. Let me go back to that step, and then at the end of the lecture I'll summarize it with an overhead. Well, what else could there be that might suggest that we restrict moral consideration just to us? Well, there's something that I mentioned last time in connection with rights, which might be relevant here, and it's that only members of Homo sapiens can make claims. And if you can't make claims, then you can't enter into any kind of contract. And if you can't enter any kind of contract, you can't be worthy of moral consideration. And I think this falls down extremely quickly. Because there are lots of members of Homo sapiens that can't make any claims. People that are not sufficiently intellectually gifted can't make claims. They just can't do it. People in comas can't make claims. Kids can't make claims. All kinds of people can't make claims. All kinds of people that we think deserve moral consideration can't enter into contracts. So the suggestion that moral consideration should be restricted to guys just like me and people just like you is far too restrictive. That's what it's saying. It's saying that adult, intelligent members of Homo sapiens are only ones that can make claims on us. To make a claim, you have to be rational, intelligent, and so on. I mention this because this has been suggested. This has been said. This has been said by one researcher called, I think it's H.J. Cohen, in a collection of articles which I've actually included on your reading list. I think it's by Botin Ed on animal experimentation. A fascinating collection of Nobel Prize winners and fellows of the Royal Society who were trying to justify their research on animals. And this guy Cohen suggested, well, animals can't make claims, therefore we can do whatever we wish with them in the laboratory. I mean, it strikes me that that argument is quite ridiculous.
That's
fine. Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. Well, that you can also then perhaps try to appeal to a legal system in that case and say that there should be a legal system which is set up in such a way that somebody will represent you.
I'm not justifying that. No, no. I'm just saying that although Though it seems ridiculous, it's very similar.
Sure. Well, I mean, if we take your point then, Simon, and say, well, now this brings in kids and people are in comas. Well, I mean, I'll make claims on behalf of my cat. So, as long as somebody can make claims on behalf of you, then the question is, of whom can claims be made on behalf of? In other words, given that somebody else can make a claim for you, then who are the other people who can't make claims? I mean, I'll include my cat in there.
Yes, why not everyone?
Well, I mean, you see, this begs the question, you see, doesn't it? I mean, the question that we had originally was, who gets moral consideration? Answer, well, guys that can make claims. Oh, but some people can't make claims. Other people can make claims on their behalf, though. Question, well, who are the people on whose behalf one can make claims? Well, cats, too.
Yeah.
In other words, this either doesn't work or it begs the question.
So, it's immoral to do experimentation on your cat.
Yeah. Nobody makes a claim on another cat, well, then you can say, well, if nobody makes a claim on this particular person who's starving in the street.
Yeah.
So it doesn't work. I don't think this defense of the contractarian position will work. You might think it does. We can talk about it more. I want to try and finish this lecture, but I'd love to read you this section here. I'll read it to you anyway. Maybe I'll read it at the end. You might also say, another attempt, which I'll go through quite quickly, that the people that have moral consideration are those which are accepted as being equal in front of the law. So you shove the question back toward the legal system, and you find that animals are not very well represented in the legal system. That in fact, if you're cruel to a dog and starve it to death, then the penalties which you have to undergo are less than if you went and robbed somebody's house and pinched their TV set. So you can chain up a dog and let it starve, and the penalty that will be accrued to you will be a lot less than if you go and pinch somebody's TV set. Of course, if the dog jumps the fence and kills your next door neighbor, case is less clear, but the former case is where the legal system doesn't seem to protect animals in the way it protects property, for instance. So you might think, well, let's appeal to the legal system in order to decide who has moral consideration. Another way to look at it. Well, I respond to that by saying, well, who says the legal system's right? I mean, there have been some legal systems in the past which have been pretty horrific. For instance, when Ulysses died, his 12 slave girls were strangled. And there have been legal systems where people have been denied suffrage, as Simon's mentioned to us. Maybe the trouble with our legal system now is it's not sufficiently advanced. And an advanced legal system would grant legal consideration to animals as well as members of Homo sapiens. Who's to say that our legal system is correct, when in the past we evaluated other legal systems, the ones of Rome and Greece, which were supposed to be very good, as simply being inadequate? The Greek one allowed Ulysses' slave girls to be strangled. The Roman one had allowed for slaves who weren't given proper consideration. So who is to say that our present legal system is the one which we can appeal to in order to answer these questions? The answer is it doesn't work. So I mention these quickly. I would have spent more time on them had I not been a bit behind with these lectures. But I don't think either of these two things, these two particular moves, work. This is a philosophical question. It's not a question that can be decided by appeal to the legal system and so on. The legal system itself should be underpinned by the correct kind of philosophy. Well, again, to come back, I'm kind of dodging backwards and forwards here, but this is the old fill-in-the-blank overhead. Some of you people are doing this seminar, and this summarizes some of the things that I've said. I could have added at the bottom, can make claims or two are incorporated under the legal system, but here's a way that you might want to try to justify restricting moral consideration to human beings. You could try these. You could say, okay, just irrational people. Well, all the guys that are not irrational have a hard, sorry, that are not rational have a hard time. You want to keep them out. People who are psychotic or neurotic or whatever other psychological diseases people have, which we generally label them as being not rational. People in hospitals for the criminally insane are not treated in quite the same way as they would be if they were rational, but they're not then denied moral consideration. They forfeited some rights, but they're not kind of experimented on. One might try the Cartesian way and have use of language. People that can't speak properly, aphasics, we're going to have a hard time under that one. People that haven't learnt language will have a hard time. People who have been struck dumb are going to have an awful hard time under those considerations. So that's not going to work either. To restrict more consideration to moral agents is the guys like us position. And that seems to be quite wrong. Probably the people that need moral consideration most are the people who, for some reason, are not full moral agents and can't look after themselves. That seems to simply beg the question completely. Having souls, well, I don't know. I find that a real problem because I don't know what a soul is. I don't know whether you determine whether somebody has a soul. If you simply define having a soul as being a member of Homo sapiens, you've begged the question because that's what the question is. Begging the question means presupposing the issue that you're trying to answer has already been answered. And that's kind of a very common mistake to make. So C, D begs the question if by having souls we mean is a member of Homo sapiens. And how else are you going to determine whether you've got a soul or not? So it begs the question. It doesn't help. A slightly more sophisticated way of doing it is to appeal to E, the potential for any one of these. One might say, okay, so an aphasiac doesn't use language, but nevertheless has the potential for using language. Well, maybe my cat has the potential for learning English, if only she had a bigger brain and a different larynx and the aptitude and the disposition. I mean, why doesn't my cat have the potential for learning English in the same sense as an aphasiac has the potential for learning English? I mean, sort of conduct a conversation with us. Look, I'm with you on this one, Karen, but maybe not in this class, you know. I think a fuller sense than just going to the fridge, understanding a few words. Again, it depends on what you mean by potential. A whole story has to be spelled out about this for it to work. You know, it's not obvious that this is going to work. A whole line of argument is going to have to be put forward for this to work. What's the argument for? Are there any really good arguments for extending moral consideration to animals? Well, Singer has one, and he refers back to Jeremy Bentham. And Jeremy Bentham said, well, recall Bentham's position about, I'll try and remember the quotation. Bentham says, it's not, don't ask of somebody whether they can, what the hell is it, whether they can think or have souls or whatever. The issue is, can they suffer? Recall Bentham's position was the maximization of pleasure, the minimization of pain. The criterion for being somebody that can experience pleasure and pain on that view for Bentham is, can you suffer? If you can suffer, presumably you can not suffer, you can do well. That for Bentham was the issue that was involved here. And he concluded that animals can suffer. Anything which can suffer, therefore, gets moral consideration. So what Bentham has here is a particular theory of the good. Consequentialism, theory of the good, is what drives everything, what wears the trousers. He has a theory of the good. The theory of the good says minimization of suffering is the thing. Since animals can suffer, they come within the sphere of moral consideration. Lumps of wood can't. Trees apparently can't either. Now, that's an argument in favor of including animals. If you read Singer, he wants to respond to people that go against that, who say, look, it's only going to be Homo sapiens here, by accusing them of something called speciesism. And he likens speciesism to racism. And I don't think I'm going to have time to discuss that at the moment. Maybe I can come back to it at some stage. But there's I'm having to go rather quickly here to cover a whole range of arguments. Singer has this thing called speciesism. How do you spell species? I.E. Well, something like that. You know, this is Scriggles, a whole lot of Scriggles. Anybody lucky enough to have a copy of Practical Ethics could perhaps read that section about speciesism. So if you agree with the kind of Singerian Benthamite position, yeah, animals are in because they can suffer. Other people have wanted to have a different position and have claimed animals have rights. This has been associated with a philosopher called Tom Regan. He claims animals actually have rights. a big difference here, because if you're a singer guy, then Thomas Cox stuff's okay, because he's a consequentialist. By making a few animals suffer, you'll stop having a whole lot of human suffering. So those middle ground of experiments are okay. For Singer, the first group, the pure scientific knowledge ones, won't do. Neither will the third group, the Lashler cosmetics. They won't do either, because the suffering is not balanced by anything. The middle group, on the other hand, by Thomas Cog, is fine, because fairly small suffering to animals, aggregate, versus a great alleviation of suffering for humans. So that's okay. So we want to evaluate our three cases on the basis of Singer's position, which seems to me to be intuitively what we want here, namely Cox's work's okay, Harlow's work on primates is not. Neither are the Dreh's tests acceptable when done for cosmetic purposes. Singer would say there. Reagan's view about rights, on the other hand, is going to rule out Robert Cox's experiments too, because this would be non-consequentialist, and it would have a principle, always respect in your actions all rights. Animals have a right not to be experimented on, just as humans don't. So this is a rather different position, and this is where I think the consequentialist Singer comes out ahead of the non-consequentialist Reagan, because to suggest that Robert Cox's experiment shouldn't have been done, well, I don't know about what you think about that, but it strikes me that's not a position that we want to be subscribing to. I want to conclude by reading you something, because I really enjoyed this when I first read it. It's weird. So I'll read it, and you, as I'm reading it, you can leave because it goes on a bit. This is written by a Nobel Prize winner called Thomas Uberl. He won the Nobel Prize for something cool like medicine. And he's writing in this collection of articles by Boating, I had on before, about animal experimentation. And it's really strange, this. And what he wants to do is to suggest that, oh yeah, look, we should be allowed to experiment animals. So I'll read you some of this stuff. The arguments of animal activists are divided into two categories, the profound and difficult on the one hand and the fatuous on the other. This is full of wonderful non sequiturs. This is wonderful kind of non sequiturs in here. First, the more difficult and older argument is that we as humans have no right to assert our domain over animals. To my mind, the very words in which this argument is couched portray a complete and profound ignorance about the ways animals exist and compete on our earth. One may or may not like it, but it's certainly clear that many animals are either predatory or prey or both. Many of the animals of this world are obligatory carnivores. If you own a cat and want to see it thrive, you don't get very far by trying to feed it carrots. That's true. You have to feed it meat. Well, you don't, actually. A few years ago, my son owned a boa constrictor, an impressive and beautiful animal, which luckily did not grow too large. To stay alive, that boa had to consume a mouse every month. To watch the boa go after a mouse was, in some macabre way, an aesthetic experience. You may not like the idea of a boa eating a mouse, you have to feed a boa on a piece of meat or a dead mouse, otherwise you'll watch it starve. Observing a phenomena like a boa eating a mouse is an educational experience from which most people in our society are excluded. Our children perhaps should see the real world as it is, rather than remain insulated in what today is something of a glass house. Over the past century, our society has undergone quite a profound change. When I was a young boy growing up in Montreal, horses walked up and down the street, pulling wagons and sleds, urinating and defecating in the process. This was part of life. If your grandmother died, her remains were kept at home. Interesting. Until the funeral she was finally taken off. Now children aren't exposed to this kind of thing at all. A relative that dies is taken straight away to what the USA we call a funeral home. One is completely isolated. Now, this is an argument against animal activists by a Nobel Prize winner. He's talking about horses in the streets and grandmothers in the front room. He's talking about boa constrictors being fed live mice. I don't see any suggestion of any kind of argument against any kind of animal activist who's denying there's any animal experimentation. This is the level of the debate that you get from some Nobel Prize winners that want to continue animal experimentation in the labs. I mean, it's simply invective, and it's very poor invective, and it's certainly not argument. So I recommend to you this argument by this article by Herr Hübel to see some of the level of debate which has taken place in recent years in opposition to people like Singer. I mean, it's just, in a word, rubbish. Okay, we'll try and finish this sequence of lectures next time. I suggest to you that the issue of whether we extend moral consideration to animals is an open one. I don't believe I've established it by any means, but what I have done is to suggest that if you want to deny it, you're going to have to come up with something that I haven't seen yet. Tutorials, seminars, I can't call them tutorials, can either continue or not. I'll let you into a secret. I've never given a person that's not attended as many as I've... Oh, no, I won't say that. Maybe I have. I've given people 0 out of 40 for some seminars. I have done that. I want to continue with what I was saying about animals. I was also supposed to talk about moral code for science in this lecture. Since this audience is so interesting and has asked me so many good questions during the lectures, I'm a little bit behind, but it doesn't really matter. We've got a bit of flexibility in this course. So if you recall what I was saying last time, I was talking about different sorts of research that has been conducted on animals. I began that lecture by reading you a section from a discussion of Lash Lure, the mascara, and said that one of the reasons why cosmetic research is being done on animals is to ensure that certain products, cosmetic products, are not toxic for the consumer, because it tends to take a little bit away from your marketing. If every time somebody uses your product they go blind or they die, it's probably not the best way to get a good market share and brand loyalty. So that was one sort of motivation for this, what I called industrial factory type research. I also was discussing some other sorts of research. I read you a passage from Singer about some pure research on monkeys, and added a few asides about research on rats. Then I was, I think, approaching the question of a certain kind of applied research, medical research, and my intention today was to begin by talking about that, saying something about, in a little bit more detail, about a particular episode of applied research, because I certainly don't wish you to form the impression in this course that I take a very strong line, how should I say, to the sort of the left of the spectrum, when I'm very strong and uncritical about things like animal rights and so on. I don't think that that's the position that we want to take in this course at all. We want to try to take a reasoned approach which is based upon justification and so on. I think I've already indicated to you that it seems to me to be just intuitively quite objectionable to subject, that particular research I read to you about Harlow and the primate research, seemed to me that's quite objectionable, that sort of research. I'm not completely convinced that some of the cosmetic research is completely unobjectionable either, and I'll say a little bit more about that. Now, as for certain sorts of applied research in a medical context, well, let's discuss that case now and see what we make about that. And I want to go back and talk to you about an episode that took place in the last century. And the work was done by Robert Koch, who was a German researcher. And he was doing work just after Louis Pasteur had developed various sorts of techniques for identifying bacteria under the microscope, staining and then observing bacteria. Those of you that have done some of the life sciences will no doubt have done this. I never did anything like that, having done physical science myself. So he was working just after Louis Pasteur, who was an innovator, of course, in those sorts of investigations. And the particular episode I want to talk briefly about is concerned with the disease TB, tuberculosis. Which have been the great ancient killers of humankind? Compared to this? Well, they kind of come and go. But these two guys, smallpox and TB, are really the two top killers. This was the biggest killer at the end of the 19th century of everybody in Europe. Tuberculosis, yeah. One of the great ancient killers. Smallpox is also one of them. The plague kind of comes and goes, but this doesn't. It stays around. We've got rid of smallpox now, I believe. Is that the case? Or have we still got some in Birmingham? Fancy the last person dying of the plague happening in Birmingham, England. I mean, that's ironic. Not sort of in war-torn Eritrea. Have I ever been to Birmingham? Good Lord.
It's more understandable than
you. I used to change trains there, you know, when I went to school. Used to change trains. Yeah, I've been to Birmingham. That's all right, Birmingham. Anyway, we won't go into Birmingham. Tuberculosis, on the other hand, is not something that's very easy to eradicate because, and this is of course necessary for the whole story, is because animals can get TB as well. They can't get smallpox. The good thing about smallpox is it's only us that can get it. So that's one way of isolating it and making sure. Yeah, of course.
From animals.
Yeah, yeah. One of the best ways to get it, of course, is to go into a room where somebody has tuberculosis and they're spitting all over the place. Because typically the sputum is one way of getting it. And that, of course, as you may know, is one of the public health measures, one of the social pressures against spitting. These things have it. I mean, why can't you go and spit? Well, one of the reasons was that you can transfer TB that way. So, you know, it's not thought of now as polite. This is one of the public health measures. So TB was a great killer. And TB typically can manifest itself in various parts of the body. And the diseases that fall under tuberculosis have different names depending upon which bit of the body it comes into. But it's cause it attacks the lungs is the prime way. And people's lungs get eaten away by the tubercule bacillus, which forms tubercule bacillus, the bacterium which is responsible, which forms nodules in the lungs and destroys the lungs. And it's sort of kind of a romantic disease in the sense that people that get it kind of turn pale and suffer and look vulnerable. And John Keats died of it. And if you've ever read Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain, that's about a tubercule clinic at the top of a Swiss mountain. Everybody was going pale, eating huge meals and sitting by the fire. So it's a good read, if you like. 600 pages of people dying of TB. a classic. So this was a very nasty, unpleasant disease. What did Robert Koch do? Well, he discovered, essentially, that this is the cause of this. Now again, the big message about all of these things is that if we're trying to figure out technologies, whatever they might be, say, technologies to prevent tuberculosis, one has to know what causes it. Trial and error is going to be no good when things get complicated. Trial and error might work when things aren't very complicated. When things get complicated, you have to understand the underlying causes, mechanisms, structures, and so forth in order to engineer a technology which is going to do what you want it to do. In this case, a medical technology or technologies of some kind which are going to help prevent this disease. You have to understand what the basis is. Okay, so the research is that Robert Koch undertook at the end of the last century were concerned to identify this bacterium and to determine that it's the cause of TB. And the way he did this was exemplary with regard to the nature of scientific method. And I have an overhead which is kind of impossible to understand, but nevertheless I'll put it up. It's very small, it's an old one. I haven't really had time to make a bigger one. See if you can see it. This just gives you some idea of, about how he proceeded. He had these various postulates. I'm looking at the ones there. Again, I apologize for this. And he set these up partly as a result of his researches and partly based upon his researches. So the causative agent of a disease, right, what causes it, clearly must be present in all cases of a disease and absent from healthy animals. He was using animals, so one of the first things he wanted to do, he was using test animals, he was using guinea pigs, rabbits, and rats. He identified the fact that this bacillus was present in diseased animals. So he would find a diseased animal, or even better, what he would do is go down to the morgue, find some person, human person, that had died of tuberculosis. He would culture, he would identify the bacillus under his microscope. They turned out to be rod-shaped things, which took up a blue dye very strongly. He'd say, go and chop up some guy, you know, find a nasty little tubercule bacillus, grab that, sort of mash it up in a dish. I don't know how it's done. You life scientists know. You know, give it something to eat, whatever bacillus like to eat, you know. Put a little I know, Chardonnay in a oyster or something like that, whatever they like, if they have any good taste. Then he'd identify them under the microscope, and he'd give them to test animals. He'd inject them to test animals. They would then get the disease. He would then kill the test animals and find, yes, indeed, these things were present in the test animals. And he would not give them to other animals. They would not get the disease. He would examine them, and he would not find this. So he would do researches into animals like guinea pigs. He would find that all the ones where they had the disease. And what does having the disease mean? Well, it means going, oh, I feel awful, going pale, looking sickly, ribs sticking out, and having these nodules. Okay, these are gross symptoms, having these nasty nodules in the lungs, or in the back, or in various places, these lesions. And then he would find within that these things. So having the disease, then, is not defined as, in this case yet, having the bacillus. It's defined as having a whole range of symptoms. All of the creatures that had the whole range of symptoms were found by Koch to have this bacillus in them. So this is the first condition for saying, this is the cause of this. So what else did he do? Quickly, I think this is of an independent interest, but it's not quite absolutely necessary. Well, the second stage, the agent of the disease, can be isolated from the diseased animal and can be grown in culture. I've suggested the first way he did this was to grow it from a human. I mean, that's, you'd want to do it that way because the interest is in having human disease, determining human disease. Again, the disease can be reproduced by inoculating a portion of pure culture into healthy animals, so you can get the disease that way. And the agent can be re-isolated. So typically what Koch would do, he would get what he maintained was some bacillus or nodule, he'd find it had rod shape, he'd culture it, he'd inoculate an animal, he'd see the animal having a disease, he'd kill the animal, he'd get something out of the tubercules, the nasty little nodules in the lungs, he'd culture them, he'd identify this bacillus, he'd re-inject it into animals, he'd find they got the disease, he might culture it a few more times, and he would go through these very, very strict conditions, and then he would conclude, yes, it's this guy that's the causative agent of the disease. Now, for him to do that, he had to have test animals. There's no way he could have done this if he didn't have the animals, because otherwise, no one would have got the disease. It's no good just culturing it and identifying it and culturing it and finding out, yeah, it came from a sick guy, but how do we know that was the cause of the disease? If the things that came from the sick guy didn't cause disease elsewhere, he couldn't go and, you know, get some people out of the prison or some third-year students or anything like that and give them a disease. He had to use an animal model for the disease. Let me read you a bit so you can... I've got a description of what he actually did in this nice book called Medical Source History. We might just read a bit. Bacteriology. Robert Koch on the etiology of tuberculosis. This is the original paper. Etiology means cause, causation. Page 392. We'll see what he did. This is what happens when you don't have a piece passage marked that you're supposed to read. Okay, I'll just read a bit here. Of six recently bought guinea pigs, not called guinea pigs for nothing. You want to stay, you want to leave. Don't worry me. Of six recently bought guinea pigs which were kept in the same cage, four were inoculated in the abdomen with tubercules and grown in five transfers, i.e., he cultured them five different times, five transfers, for 54 days. Two animals remained uninoculated. In the inoculated animals, the inguinal lymph nodes, I believe they're in the groin, 12 after 14 days, the site of inoculation changed into an ulcer and the animals became emaciated, typical symptoms of tuberculosis. After 32 days, one of the inoculated animals died, and after 35, the rest were killed. The inoculated guinea pigs, the ones who had died spontaneously, as well as the three killed ones, showed far advanced tuberculosis of spleen, liver, and lungs. Well, that is to say, they have the tubercules in the spleen, liver, and lungs. The inguinal nodes were much swollen and caseated, i.e. hardened. The bronchial lymph nodes were but little swollen. The two non-inoculated animals displayed no trace of tuberculosis in lungs, liver, or spleen. And then, of course, he found that they had this particular bacillus identified by the blue dye. Well, what do we make of this research? Well, perhaps I won't comment further on it just now. Relatively small numbers of animals are being used here. He didn't have to use thousands and thousands and thousands of them. He used 6 guinea pigs in that particular experiment. I recall that there were around 100 test animals used altogether for his sequence of experiments, no more than that. The question is, how do we evaluate that kind of research? What do we say about it? Do we say Robert Koch was justified in using those animals to do this research or not? Well, we don't yet have any principles which are allowing us to make that kind of judgment. But I think it seems to me to be fairly clear that in that particular case I've described, it's really very different from simply finding out how much you can make a monkey suffer before it'll smash its daughter's head on the ground, or why you have to use lots and lots of rabbits in order to make better mascara. I mean, this seems to be kind of more important and significant research. And of course, clearly, if you're a consequentialist, you're going to say, that's great, that research, that's fabulous, and it's entirely justified to use 100, 150 rabbits in order to find out that this is the cause of that, and then provide a basis on which to develop therapies in order to help combat that disease. Now, it seems to me that's a rather different case, and the consequentialists, of course, are going to give it a thumbs up. The consequences are millions of people are going to be better off, i.e. all the guys that don't get tuberculosis because of the work that Robert Koch did, for the sake of a few animals. That seems okay. Again, this is just an intuition that one has based upon consequentialism. There might well be a lot more to say about that case. So what I've done then so far, I submit, is the following. I've tried to give you 3 examples of research using animals. The first example was just stuff I read from Singer, and the essence of that case was we're just finding out stuff, just finding out particular bits of knowledge and information and so on about animals. We're finding out something about their behavior, something about their physiology, and so on, to be recorded in a scientific journal and maybe to be used later. If it is actually going to be used, and we know that, it's not pure research anymore, it's applied research. Okay, that was the first kind of case. The second case was the one I just did. And the third case, let me read a bit more about the third case. I can read on a little bit more about the rash lure case. And we will see a little bit more about what that involves here. This is to just make the aftermath of the rash lure case a bit more. Scientists had begun to study eye irritation in the 1920s after soldiers were exposed to poisonous gas in World War I. Scientists studied the effects of mustard gas in rabbits' eyes to compare with human experience. In 1938, other experimenters used rabbits to look at more chemicals to determine eye irritation. Finally, in 1944, Food and Drug Administration scientist John Drays standardized the rabbit model and came up with an irritation scoring system, which has been the basis of the much maligned Drays eye test. That was based upon the degree of ulceration in rabbits' eyes. At about the same time that rabbits began to be used as models for human eye irritation, the LD50, the lethal dose for 50%, got its start. In 1927, a British pharmacologist, J.W. Treven, was faced with the task of standardizing the production of highly toxic drugs. To come up with a statistically precise measurement of toxicity, he injected groups of rats and mice with different amounts of each drug to see which dose would kill half a test group. Because the drugs were so toxic,
precise measurements were necessary, and more than 100 animals were used for each testing. The LD50 test, lethal dose 50 test. So this is a standardized way of determining eye irritation, and this was a way of determining drug toxicity. In and of themselves, well, we could make some judgment about that, but the context of these things, I mean, if they're being used in the cosmetics industry, for instance, and let's assume that they are, well, this is clearly a different kind of case from the case I've just considered. So there are three sort of groups of examples of the use of animals. In the second and third case, the animals are used as models, that is to say, they're used to represent human beings. Now, presumably the effects on animals are going to be the same kind of effects that you get from human beings. They're used as models for us. In the first case, the pure research case, it's simply that scientists are trying to find out about animals. Now, what about all this? I mean, how do we come to grips with it? Do we simply appeal to consequentialism and non-consequentialism and so on? Well, I don't think it's quite that simple, because we need to say a little bit more about it. If we were simply talking about human beings, members of Homo sapiens, fully rational members of Homo sapiens, we might immediately move on to consequentialism and non-consequentialism and try to give some evaluation of this. For instance, we might even consider the case where Robocock is using human subjects. Suppose there ain't no animals around, or suppose animals don't get tuberculosis. Would it have been justified for Robert Koch to use 100 prisoners from the local jail to do these experiments in, if it was the case that those 100 prisoners would be killed, but nevertheless, Koch would have determined the cause of tuberculosis? A consequentialist would probably say, well, probably. So what would a consequentialist say of those experiments the Chinese, that the Japanese did at, what's it called, Linping, what was it called? In Manchuria. Ping Fang. Ping Fang in Manchuria. That was the human experimental facility that the Japanese had during the Second World War in Manchuria, where they did some fun experiments on seeing the effects of gas gangrene on human subjects and plague on human subjects and so on. They referred to the people there, this was referred to as the lumber mill. That was the euphemism used. The lumber mill, and the people who were in there were referred to as logs, or what was the Japanese word for it? Maruta, maratas, or logs. That was what the human subjects were called, because they weren't regarded as anything more than lumber for the mill. Now, there's been debate about those experiments, not as to whether they were justified, but whether one is allowed to make use of the results. Should the results simply be burned, or should one be allowed to actually make use of those results? The Americans, I think, wanted to make use of them. Other people said, no, this is so abhorrent, you can't even make use of the results. Like some of the Nazi experiments. It's very hard, I believe, for instance, to really determine things like how long folk can survive in cold water without actually putting them in cold water and seeing how long they survive. And the Germans and Nazis did some experiments of that kind for airmen. And I think the results are useful because no one else is allowed to do those experiments. There's no animal model for them. The questions have arisen, are you allowed to make use of those results? Or does it imply some kind of complicity with the procedures? Anyway, those are discussable propositions. If it was human beings, I think we could simply appeal to consequentialism or non-consequentialist substantial theories of morality and make some kind of judgment. With animals, it's rather more difficult. What does this depend on, then? How are we going to evaluate these particular cases? Well, it strikes me that it's going to have to depend upon, well, our attitude toward animals. What do we think about animals? I mean, what's the status of animals in regard to human beings? And the attitude that we have toward animals is going to depend upon our beliefs about animals. So what's our attitude toward them? Is the attitude one where we think they deserve some kind of moral consideration, maybe not as much as members of Homo sapiens, but some? That attitude is going to depend, I suggest, on our beliefs stroke knowledge of animals. Let me illustrate that by considering some particular cases. Let's suppose that we adopt a rather uncritical Christian position on this matter. And we read, is it the Old Testament? where it says God gave man dominion over the beasts of the field and the fowls of the air. If what that means is that God said, well, you've got carte blanche, do whatever you like, eat them, experiment on them, you know, poke them with sticks, when they meow, don't feed them, all that kind of stuff. If that's what that means, then, and if you believe that, and if you're kind of a fairly, I suggest, uncritical Christian, you might say, okay, well, my attitude toward animals is one purely for exploitation. There's absolutely nothing to stop me doing what the hell I like with animals, because God said I could, so to speak. At least as my beliefs about them is going to be conditioned by that, and my beliefs are then based upon the Bible. If you hold that view, then presumably do whatever you like. And of course, what would be the foundation of that position would be that animals have no soul. And the only things that have moral consideration in this world are things with souls, i.e. members of Homo sapiens. And if something doesn't have a soul, it doesn't deserve moral consideration. And so questions of morality don't come in. And therefore the only reason perhaps to prevent us from doing those sorts of experiments that one might think are abhorrent would be that it would diminish us as human beings. Perhaps conducting the experiments that were described it by Singer about Harlow, and there are worse experiments that have been done to animals to cause them more suffering, the only reason not to do them would have been because it would diminish us as human beings. It would make us seem cruel. Creatures with souls don't do that kind of thing. But as for an argument, that's kind of tenuous. I mean, I don't see why it shouldn't be put the other way around. I mean, on this view, animals are just like lumps of wood. They're nothing. That we have dominion over, do what we like with them. It's as if they're dead trees. They're not important to us. I mention this because this has been influential. I mean, this is an influential position. It's not something I'm making up. It's something that's been influential. So that kind of Christian belief, and of course I'm not suggesting that's the only kind of Christian belief, I'm suggesting it's a very uncritical reading of the Bible. A more critical reading might understand the word dominion to have the implication of stewardship, and stewards look after stuff. They don't kind of stuff it up. They look after it. So another reading might come to a different conclusion for that. And the other reading, of course, would give us different kinds of beliefs. This other reading would, it's a different reading, it therefore gives us different beliefs about things, and therefore would condition a different kind of attitude. So, that's an example of one way in which one might deal with this. I'm going to give you a couple more, because this has kind of been historically influential. Another one which would give us the same kind of result as the uncritical reading of the Bible will be based upon a view of animals derived from the philosopher René Descartes, 17th century, going right back here. And he was very influential, that's why I mention it. He was very influential. And Descartes' position had some resemblance to the biblical one in the sense that he believed that, well, in effect, animals had no souls, and he believed that for the following reason. He thought that there were two kinds of things in the universe, things which thought, i.e. thinking beings, and non-thinking beings. Could you tell which could think and which couldn't? Well, thinking beings had language, and non-thinking beings did not. Anything which didn't think, according to Descartes, had precisely the same status. He thought animals were similar to automata, to machines. As far as he was concerned, anything which on his view was not thinking had the same status as a machine, an automata, a lump of wood. Just essentially, an automata, you know, something that appears to move, but in fact it's got some mechanical contrivance inside it. He actually thought animals had mechanical contrivances inside them. He kind of thought we did too, but in addition to that, we had a thinking bit, a soul, if you like, and that's what distinguished us from everything else. We, members of Homo sapiens, were unique in the physical universe, not in the heavenly one, as being thinking, and we could use language, and we had a soul, and we deserve moral consideration. Everything else had the same status. Animals would have the same status as lumps of wood. So again, that would license any kind of behavior. You lie to animals because it's like, you know, tinkering with a TV set. Doesn't hurt it, doesn't affect it, doesn't do anything to it. That was historically very influential. Now we come on to the next bit, and we see the influence of science on all this. Because you might say, well, surely this is a highly unscientific position, for at least one reason. I mean, it's by no means evident that animals can't use language. Indeed, Descartes perhaps didn't have a very sophisticated view of what language was. Certainly animals can communicate with each other. And it does seem there's evidence to suggest that the level of communication which they have can be regarded as being a kind of language. Indeed, it's been suggested that there have been some animals, a chimpanzee by the name of Washoe is the case that I recall, that actually learnt some English and knew up to 200 words. And of course, there are members of Homo sapiens that know a lot less than 200 words. So if one wished to press this distinction, you'd actually find out that some animals would be going over here and some members of Homo sapiens would be coming over in this direction. And that is not quite the desired result. Now, a couple of things could be said about that immediately. One is, it's by no means clear that animals can't have an animal language. And if language is the thing which is important about thinking, you know, maybe animals are thinking. My cat thinks all the time, out loud. And it's also by no means clear that animals can't perhaps understand some of our language. Now, this kind of conclusion, these kind of conclusions, is based upon scientific research. Science is telling us these things. There's even more significance that science has with regard to this, destroying this distinction, and that's the theory of evolution of the 19th century. If we look at 19th century biological science and the suggestion that in fact we evolve from animals, then where's the sharp distinction between us and animals in that way? If we're simply a gradation of species, we're at the end of a line of evolution, the dissimilarity between us and animals is just about broken. There seems to be some kind of continuous line of development. But